Welcome to Genuine Life Recovery. We're here to help you and your loved ones overcome addictions and other addiction-related mental health challenges. In this show, we dive into the physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual aspects of addiction, mental health, recovery, family dynamics, codependency, and more. You can listen on your favorite app or at jodystevens.org. Genuine Life Recovery is made possible by great friends like Joshua's Heart, in memory of Joshua Brent Moore, bringing hope, love, and awareness to those afflicted by addiction, online at joshasheart.org, and Jody Stevens Productions for commercial voiceover, narration, production, MC, and public speaking, online at jodystevens.org. Hey friends, welcome back to Genuine Life Recovery. I'm Jody Stevens and I am joined by Tracy Norris. Tracy is going to share her personal journey through her battle with her son and addiction and his eventual death from a fentanyl overdose. We're going to talk that. We're going to talk about fentanyl. We're going to talk about what it is, how kids are being targeted, early warning signs, what moms and dads need to know, what young people need to know, how you can get involved, Tracy's book, and also the work that she's doing to bring fentanyl awareness to people. So Tracy, thank you so much for coming on and being willing to share and talk about this difficult emotional topic of the loss of your son.
Jody, thanks so much for having me. I am just honored to the opportunity. In grieving the loss of my son, the one thing that really has helped me, the one thing that has given me just a peace, is knowing that his story has the power to impact other people. And by sharing it, we have the opportunity to not have let him pass in vain. And so this truly is my heart's desire, just to spread awareness about the dangers of fentanyl poisoning, what fentanyl is. A lot of parents like myself, leading up to Marcus's passing, I'd never even heard of fentanyl until he introduced me to the word. So I'm confident I'm not alone in that. However, the last few years, we've seen such an uptick, right, in families impacted. As a matter of fact, today, it's highly unlikely that most people either don't know someone who has experienced a fentanyl overdose, or at least know someone that knows someone, right? We all have that story in the back of our minds.
Wow. Well, Marcus, we have to take a moment to remember Marcus. And I don't have kids, but my brother died of addiction and my dad found him, you know, dead. And so I understand the grief of dealing with addiction and how you feel like, wow, right? As a mom, nobody's sending me flowers like my, you know, other kids that have, it's very lonely. It's very, it's grueling because there's so many things people don't understand or why, you know, are you enabling and all that stuff. So I my heart goes out to you. So, Tracy, where are you? Because I was connected with you through our mutual friend, Lauren Hunter, who's my business coach as I'm trying to juggle different things. So are you in the Sacramento area?
I am. Yes.
Oh, okay.
And Lauren had helped coach me through the writing process and really unraveling, untangling a lot of those grief pieces and helping me to find a way. So.
Wow. Yeah, I did morning drive for the Fish. I worked for the Fish Radio for 17 years in Sacramento.
All right. No stranger to the area.
I know. So now we're in Reno now. But okay, well, take us back. Just kind of share the story of Marcus, you know, sort of maybe the earlier years and what happened that led to his addiction, and just kind of give us the story.
Happy to. Yeah. So, I was a single mom, in and out of a relationship with his dad. And at the time I did not understand the impact of those relationships, right? I was also a teenage mom. And so a lot of his early experiences were us just growing up together. And there's a lot of good in that. And there's a lot of hard in that. And so Marcus was a kiddo that was exposed to toxicity in relationships. He was a kiddo that was exposed to a lot of early childhood trauma. And I think that as parents, professional stakeholders, it's really important to take just that step back and to understand how important the modeling that we provide young children is to their overall development. Yeah. And now I have worked through a lot of self-blame around the things that Marcus has been exposed to, poverty, even homelessness. There was a period of time that he and I, we were legally homeless. We lived with friends and families moving around, and there were even nights that he spent in a vehicle. So super important to hold space for the impact that being raised in toxic stress has on young children. In Marcus's case, I would say definitely driving factors to his eventual falling into addiction. Marcus, though, he was a thrill seeker. And he was just that kid that if there was something naughty to get into, boy, he was going to do it. And had I understood or known better, that would have been a great opportunity to be like, hey, let's go learn how to do some rock climbing safely, or let's explore that internal desire to be a risk taker through some healthy outlets. So not knowing is not knowing, though, right? So we take what we have and we move forward with it. Super, super blessed with Marcus's adventurous spirit and just the grace and compassion that he had for people. He loved people so much. And so these are the things that kind of offset that in just reflecting on who he was and all the different pieces of Marcus. We were separated, though, from his biological father by state. So my second husband, my current husband, he's in the military. And so we would move. And that distance between himself and his dad was just a big traumatic heartbreak for him also. So just like he had these super young traumas and then impacted by distance, separation, all of the things that our military kiddos do go through pretty regularly. So his coping mechanisms just weren't there to offset a lot of the challenges that he faced. And so unfortunately, he did fall into experimentation, which quickly led to addiction.
Wow. So it's so true that like so many people that fall into addiction, they have underlying issues or coping skills. And then unfortunately, they're kind of their little brains kind of developing through that. So it almost feels like the drugs or the alcohol is sort of like a survival mechanism. But I think it's really cool that you recognize that, you know, as a parent. I think that's super important. But obviously working through the blame and not taking the blame, because ultimately we all grow up, right? We make our own choices and things like that. But it's nice that you're able to see that and help educate other parents on, hey, look, you know, there's underlying trauma. And then you also saw, you know, you can look back and realize that you had seen some of the warning signs. Right. They don't teach us parents that, right?
They you know? They don't. And that's the piece of the conversation that matters so much to me, because now here I am, nearly 50 years old, and I'm a mama again. I'm raising his baby. And so these lessons, they're not something I take lightly. As an educator, as someone working with parents frequently, it's my position to really talk about, this child is struggling with, and whatever it is, let's name it. Let's talk about where the challenges are. And Jody, by being able to call that out and have those conversations right now, my heart is that we're going to be able to shape some children who are not going to have those gaps, right? Marcus had some big gaps. And unfortunately, at that time, I did not have the skills to help him. But there are so many children that this information is going to be helpful for.
Wow. And how were you able to work through the pain, the guilt? Obviously, it's a lifelong process because it's only been a few years. I know you have faith in the Lord, and I know that that is so powerful. And I can tell, you know, I can tell people that do and don't lean on God for strength, you know.
So you said it, Jody, it is not over. This process, I fully anticipate my grief process to last the rest of my life. I fully Even love that. I love that because it feels almost a little bit. What does it feel? Unloving, ungiving to move forward and not just hold space for Marcus, his big impact in who I am. And so I'm good with growing with my grief. God has given me so much peace. My son, he was an addict. He wasn't this kid we're talking about. We're talking right now about the fentanyl epidemic, and one pill can kill, and it can. But that wasn't my son. My son was tormented on earth. He was stuck in addiction and he was in pain. But I have great peace knowing that his soul is with the Lord and he's in blissful eternity, and it is well with my soul.
I love that. Well, kind of take me through the progression of his addiction, because I believe if fentanyl wasn't around, he'd probably still be alive.
He would. You
know. Now, whether that's a good or a bad thing, it's hard to say. And I only say that for people that have lost people to addiction. So, you know, because when my brother finally passed, while there was grief, there was also relief. I hate to say it, because it was just torment for so many years. It was like, okay, God, fix him or take him away. We can't keep doing this.
We just
can't keep doing it. You know, and then when he was gone, it was like, the crazy is over. You know? I think, you know, the fentanyl, I worked for an opiate treatment center, and I mean, people would come in very young, like 22, and they'd already had like 3 overdoses. Okay, that just didn't used to happen. Like when we were kids, if somebody had an overdose, it was like, oh my gosh. Now it's just common. They're ODing. So anyway, that was a loaded question. But yeah, kind of take us through that and how you think maybe he got introduced to the fentanyl.
So, boy, loaded question. Yes, Marcus's addiction, the path to addiction. He was a young teenager, so 14, 15 years old when we were like, okay, he's experimented with marijuana. Let's start some treatment. Let's get him into counseling. At 15, Marcus went to adventure therapy. He had the most incredible experience, 45 days backpacking through Alaska.
That's where I'm from.
Oh, me too. Kind of. Anyway,
I grew up in Anchorage and went to college in Fairbanks.
UAF.
Sorry. Did you go to UAF
for my undergrad?
Oh my gosh! I graduated University of Alaska Fairbanks in '95.
Oh, bless you. goodness, much later, like 2018, long time later. Anyway,
wow. Okay, moving on. But still, when you find someone else from Alaska, you gotta stop and
embrace that. So yeah, he did Alaska Crossings. I don't know if you're familiar with the program, but it's at risk youth. So before that, he had done his seventh, eighth grade years. He went off to Galena for the boarding school there, and just all these different things that we were trying as a family. Like Marcus is really showing some challenges. He tried adventure therapy. He tried boarding school. He tried inpatient, outpatient. His trajectory. We dug deep into the resources in our community. We dug deep. To eventually go ahead and say, okay, Marcus is really wanting to be back home in California with family. So we made the decision to go ahead and let him go to California, which just started this. Marcus always had an unsettling. So we moved a lot. He moved a lot his whole childhood. And then we went to the military and he moved even more. And so he just was rootless. And that served him well as a aspiring at the time addict, because you're in places for pockets of time and it's always a party because you're new and fresh to the scene and everybody's excited to see you. And so what happened for Marcus is as that new would wear off, he would instigate fights or arguments or find reasons to get ready for that next leg of his adventure. And he was just this gypsy soul, always on the go, stayed for the party and then moved on. And so early, I would even say our desperation and help my son, let's see if this will help or this will help or this will help, even fed into that, because he was still establishing that pattern that existed for the rest of his life. He was never able to break that pattern of try this, that didn't work, move on to this, if that makes sense. So that's his preteen, teenage years, really digging deep into exploring, learning to be super independent, not really need anybody, but not ever needing much or wanting much.
Well, and there's a lot of hiding in that. You know, they talk about in recovery that anybody can recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And when we're jumping around and we're just the life of the party, we're not, you know, it's we got that false front. We've got that, you know, nobody can really see me. And by the time they start to, I've moved on, you know. And so then you're like feeling alone in the crowd and no one ever really knows you, you know.
So eventually that it was really the I'll try this, I'll try that. I'm able to try anything. No kind of real like addiction. But from a mom's perspective, I could see him able to pick it up and put it down. So that didn't serve my logic of addiction. My logic of addiction says I have to have it or I can't function. Now, it was not until fentanyl that Marcus showed that trait. Physical, I cannot put it down, never existed for my son until fentanyl.
A lot of people say that about opiates too, that you don't even have to have, you know, we talk about underlying issues and environmental factors and childhood trauma and addictions and all those things are super valid. And I had all of them, you know, but, but with opiates, a lot of times people just, they try it and they are just hooked, and it's incredibly hard to come off that stuff. That's, you know, people are like, oh, I don't like methadone, or I don't like this, or I don't like that, and they just need to quit. But it, I mean, people are so afraid of the detox of opiates, you know.
We were
so did he start with heroin and then lead to fentanyl? Did he think he was getting different drugs? Because people would come in and they always thought that they were doing heroin, and we'd be like, yeah, no, you're doing fentanyl. And so the dealers, they lie.
They do. Yeah. And for Marcus, now I don't really know, but he always told me that he'd never done heroin or never planned to or intentionally done heroin, that his drug of choice was methamphetamine. But I do know now that fentanyl, it's laced in marijuana, it's laced in Xanax, it's laced in everything. I work closely with and have a good friend who lost her child to carfentanil. And
Gosh, that's like even worse than fentanyl. That's elephant tranquilizer.
It is.
If
and
I,
it was
if
just,
I...
Yeah, you're exactly right. So it was in it was a bottle of water that the odorless, colorless carfentanil was put into. And so really he's more aligning with that one pill can killer, definitely fentanyl poisoned person, where it's not a popular opinion or choice of words, but I would say that Marcus doesn't fit that bill. Marcus overdosed. He is not that one pill can kill like that kiddo is.
The other thing about it, though, is it's so strong that it's causing people to overdose that wouldn't normally overdose. And it's a very different drug, because then when you quit taking it, if you go back and take it again, you're very likely to overdose. It's very scary. Talk to me about fentanyl, what it is, and what people need to know about it.
So fentanyl first came on the scene not as the illicitly manufactured fentanyl that we're seeing today, right? Originally developed for medical uses under stringent care in a medical setting. Super common still today. I had a minor procedure a few weeks ago as I'm coming out, I hear them saying, and we gave her fentanyl. My mama card's like,
I know. Now we're all freaked out, but like they've been using it for years and years and years.
It's not the same as what they're making in a garage, right? So illicitly manufactured fentanyl. So this is happening in garages. It's happening by people who don't have the higher level chemistry degrees or these sanitary environments to be doing this work. They're just throwing stuff together and putting it out on the street as quick as they can. So coming in over the borders, coming in through our mail systems, coming in just in every illegal route possibly from the cartels. And really the intention which behind getting it over here, that's a whole other hot topic. So not even going to go there just yet, only that they know that it will take lives. And they know that it's highly, highly addictive. So the customer could be somebody that just had laced marijuana, right? Laced whatever else their drug of preference is. But now they have this internal urge that's saying, I need to have fentanyl. I need to have it now. They figure out what it was and they went more and more of it. Just a second ago, Jody, you touched on something that's really important to me. You talked about how after having tried it, your tolerance, right? It keeps building up and building up. And in our story, Marcus was right out of rehab again. He'd been to rehab several times, but this time he actually graduated. He had his little certificate that he was ready to reenter society. And he did not live a full month on the outside of rehabilitation. And my core belief is that's because he had lost that tolerance that he had built up over time. And sure, I could take that much. I used to take that much in my sleep, right? But they do, they lose the tolerance that they've built up over time. And what would kill your eye very quickly and easily, they're great with. This is normal for them. And so for Marcus, and I know for a lot of other people who fall into the addiction bucket, that's what happened, is that tolerance is gone. The substance is back in the body and you don't have that blocker for the opioids. It's just attacking your body.
And it's my understanding it's 50 times stronger than heroin, roughly. Like 100 times stronger than morphine.
100 times stronger than morphine. Just taking that into perspective, or just how little those two teeny tiny little milligrams. We've all seen the image at this point because it's not brand new anymore, right? The penny, right. Just a couple little specks right next to it. And that's enough. That's enough to kill us. It's enough to take a life. And it is happening. It's happening every 5 minutes. It's happening.
Wow.
In our schools, in our parks, right? At the mall. So it's everywhere. It's rampant. I'd like to talk briefly just about Narcan administration. I think that...
I have a couple of them in my purse, you know. I carry it with me because, right. I mean, you just never know.
You never know. That's right. So I think it's so simple now to administer Narcan, but it still feels not simple or scary or overwhelming and taxing. So just want to get that message out there as loud and clear as we can, that we need to be ready to respond. Carrying Narcan doesn't mean that you're a likely candidate to have an overdose. And right, we still have stigmas attached to all things addiction and substance abuse. So, she's carrying Narcan, she must have a substance abuse problem. That's not an issue. That's not reality. The fact of the matter is that driving down the road, you may need to pull over your car and administer that Narcan. So having it, we need to kill that stigma right away. And we need to be comfortable, ready to act. And so it's just that quick nasal spray. It's super easy, like Afrin, right? Same thing. Stay with them and make sure you've called for emergency services. So I feel like that piece of the conversation is missing, because people know that we need to administer Narcan, but that it's super easy and you can do it. You can do it. And it will save a life, or it definitely will help in saving a life.
Yeah, it's just like a little nasal.
Yeah.
Like the stuff you buy, like a nasal decongestant, and you just squirt it up their nose and it literally blocks the opiate, you know, from getting into the brain. It's what they call like an opioid antagonist or something like that. But it reverses the effect of an overdose. And that's such a huge deal, especially as we know with kids being targeted and stuff like that. You know, I would recommend anybody have it. Keep it in your house. I mean, you got kids mm-hmm. over and stuff like that. You have no idea. Several moms on the program that have lost mm-hmm. their kids, teenage mm-hmm. kids to it really young because mm-hmm. they, like one kid got what he thought was a Xanax. Well, a Xanax, I mean, that's not going to, normal Xanax would do very little to you. It's just a tranquilizer. I've been prescribed it for when I had an anxiety disorder, you know, so he gets one Xanax and he dies. I mean, he overdoses and dies. I mean, this is
horrific.
So they're starting to like charge some of these people with murder when they do this, because that is actually murder.
You know, if you're
putting fentanyl and selling a Xanax. So, yeah, I mean, talk to me about that. The what's happening with the kids, the fake pills. Snapchat was a big place.
Snapchat was huge. Yeah.
It's probably changed. It moves so fast, you know, with the kiddos, but.
It does. And they keep it shifting. So I try really hard to stay abreast of like the current emojis and things that they're sending out.
Yeah.
Now, I have a 5-year-old in my house. I don't have that age kiddo, but I also think it's super important to stay aware and to be able to share this information with parents. And so knowing that as parents or other stakeholders, they catch on, these kids are smart, they're going to switch up those emojis, right? So just kind of being savvy and able to read some of that communication is huge. We still are dealing with one pill can kill, and so many innocent victims, so many people not struggling with addiction, so many people just completely unaware. So Jody, my challenge then to society, because I just really believe this is a core belief for me. Kiddos are so present. They're so aware. They take it all in. And what they see is maybe like, oh my gosh, Jody, I have such a terrible headache. Do you have a Tylenol, right? Simple thing, Tylenol, right? No big deal. But we've normalized then the accepting of medication from one person to another. And we normalize it over and over again. I've got allergies or hay fever. I need a Tums, right? All the time, this back and forth, and they see it. Mom's digging into her purse and opening up her little, oh, which one?
Mm.
So it feels more innocent, which technically it is. But when they have the same practice or habits in their own life, when they don't understand that mom bought this and mom is giving it, and this is a trusted source to a trusted source, and exactly what that means and where the lines are drawn, they're not ready for that. So as young children, just watching as in society, either in their homes or out in the community, they're seeing this over and over again. It's embedded in their brains and in their minds that it is okay to take something simple and easy from somebody that's just going to help us. But knowing when that's safe and not safe in today's society, I'm going to say it's just not safe if it's not prescribed to you.
Yeah. Well, and almost they're saying like most of the stuff that's not subscribed has fentanyl in it.
Correct.
Like most of it, you know, obviously marijuana, maybe not, but they're putting it in everything now.
Yeah, so the DEA put out that it's 7 out of every 10 pills, 7 out of 10 are going to have fentanyl in them. And when it has fentanyl in them, we don't know which part of the pill has fentanyl. We don't know how much fentanyl. They have no idea that the people manufacturing, and I wanted to be like the chemists, right? The people behind the scenes doing the work, they do not know which pill has a lot of fentanyl, which one just doesn't even have any. They have no idea. It's Russian roulette.
Yeah. Yeah, they liken it to like a chocolate chip cookie, you know, where, you know, you break, because even kids have died where they break a pill in half and one kid gets the fentanyl and one doesn't. Because like you said, a couple grains of salt is lethal for someone who's never had fentanyl. So if you're someone who's manufacturing this and you're not a chemist, like you said, and most of them aren't, they're kind of just dumping it in there. I mean, they really are. It's coming across the border. They're getting some of the stuff from China, then it goes to Mexico.
And then
by the time it comes to us, you know, who knows, you know, and obviously, they're drug dealers, so they really don't care. I mean, you know, let's just put it out there like it is. And so, you know, you don't know what you're getting. I mean, you know, I have a history of drugs and alcohol, particularly alcohol. And you know, this was in the 80s and 90s. You knew what you were getting. Right. I never had bought marijuana that was laced with something. I wasn't a pill person, but if I had one, you knew what it was. And now, I mean, that's what's crazy. Now it's they're taking everything and kind of making it one thing because they know how addicting it is. Right. Yeah. So it's going to be more addicting than Xannies or this or that. So we just put it in everything. They'll all get addicted. We'll all make money. I mean, that's what I think it is, you know, honestly.
I had this conversation just this week with a mama whose child had a, thank God, non-fatal incident and totally unsuspecting in this situation. It was a complete accident. Kiddo had no idea. It was a food item, right? So he received some food from another person. On a school campus. So receiving food from another person. And my heart is just breaking for her and just saying, listen, once they've been exposed, there's something that happens and we have to be so aware and so on purpose and make sure that we're really handling this very, very well so that that addiction or that internal desire, that pull does not take him down a road that he doesn't need to be traveling.
Mm. So this kid got fentanyl from food.
Mm-hmm. It was children sharing food at a school. Yep. He said, hey, can I have one of those cookies? And other children said, oh, yeah, sure. And kind of there was some snickering that did happen. And he picked up on that, but didn't make the connection until much, much later, unfortunately.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and they make it look like candy as well.
Oh, yep. Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, the Skittles and all those sorts of things, which is scary because, you know, that's what kids like.
Right. No, and coming right now into Valentine's Day, I have seen already the release of some pink, fluffy little candies that are laced with fentanyl. And so just an extra awareness. I don't know if you remember, was it last October they pushed out with the Halloween treats that really had fentanyl in them. So this year the rendition is just be on the lookout for.
I had a DEA agent tell me that the gal would make them pink because pink sold better. People just like to buy pink pills. Like, oh my gosh.
Look at that. Yeah, I had no idea, but that's, not surprising.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, what do you want parents, moms, and dads to know about what's going on about fentanyl and opiates in general?
So I think the number one takeaway is we cannot over-communicate. We cannot talk about it too much. We cannot... sometimes it feels like we're browbeating or just getting too close in their space. And during this awkward time with especially our preteens and teenagers where they are pulling away, right? It's our responsibility that they have the information. They need to know how dangerous it is. They need to know that fentanyl is rising on the scene, that it is there in our community. It is in your child's school. It is at the park. It is at the mall. It is in every corner of our lives. And we have a lot of work ahead of us in making sure that our children are well-educated, good advocates for themselves, and prepared to respond if one of their friends needed their assistance.
And what would you tell parents to maybe how to communicate, A, and B, maybe what to look for warning signs with their child?
So first of all, with communication, my experience has taught me that I should have been very direct, but also very general. I think that it's so, you just can't overemphasize the importance of your child knowing that you have all the confidence in the world in them and the choices that they make. By all means, they're human, they're going to make mistakes, and that's not going to change one thing about the way you feel about them. So this assurance of acceptance, regardless, right? Knowing that no matter what, I'm in your corner, I am here for you, and you can talk to me about anything.
Yeah,
that spirit has to be there so that the trust doesn't go anywhere and that you're able to pour into them. I have found it to be very successful. to talk about, hey, if you're out with friends and you see a friend slumped over, slurring their words, a friend who was talking to you and alert and suddenly slumped over, this is when you're going to need to use your Narcan, when they are drooling and vomiting, when their eyes start to just all of a sudden droop, when they become obviously altered from the person that you were just talking to a few minutes ago. These are the things that you're going to be looking for, parents, for your children, and then as well in those conversations with your children, so that they know what to be looking for, when to ask for help, when to administer Narcan. I think it's really important also to hold space for those victims who were left to die because their friends were scared. When we're talking to our kids, when we're talking to their friends, when we're just talking in general about addiction and fentanyl and overdose, knowing that it doesn't matter if maybe somebody's going to get in trouble. It doesn't matter if a lot of times they're just afraid of the situation, right? If you can't handle it and you need to go somewhere else, just make sure you make that call and make sure that somebody knows where he is or the person is that's needing help. So I know that fear is hard. Trauma and stress of something like this happening, it's hard. But sometimes we just have to do hard things.
And the young brain is like, oh, my mom will kill me, so I can't say anything. And yet here's this kid dying. And that, I mean, you know, and obviously, so I think having that conversation is huge, and talking about what are the names of this stuff, you know, and most kids, I mean, they already know. They already know a lot of stuff. So I feel like it's coming alongside them. Have you talked to me about fentanyl? Have you heard about it? You know, maybe let them educate you maybe a little, and then you kind of have this back and forth. And then,
I love that.
You know, I think that piece is really huge, because, you know, when you, I watched this thing, these young girls, about stuff that was going on online, and it was crazy. I mean, they know so much that we'd probably be blown away about, you know. So I think that,
you know, so that's over, right? Just 2.5 years ago, when Marcus first said fentanyl to me, I was like, fentanyl, what? And since then, it's everywhere. We all know. So you're right, Jody. They know, and there's plenty they can teach you. What they need to know is that your trust for them, your love for them, your relationship with them isn't changed by fentanyl. We need to have these conversations openly. You need to know that I'm in your corner and I support you.
And I think it's good if they have Narcan, the kids have it. I mean, I know that maybe that sounds weird, but can you imagine, you know, especially on Halloween, there's kids overdosing. If they had that, if they had a way to test it, you know, they have the little test that's not always accurate, but you can stick it in water. I mean, I guess it evaporates. I don't know. But, well, they have test strips and stuff like that is going to be important, because a lot of kids, you know, they just want to be cool. And so they're going to take the pill. But if a kid said, you know, this might have fentanyl, this could kill us, we should test it, I don't know how many kids would go, oh, no, let's not. I mean, right? So, I mean, there's other options if they're armed with stuff, you know, so that might help. I mean, you know.
So the testing strips are interesting to me. I am kind of like in the middle of the road on these things, because you break a pill and you test the half and then you're going to take the other half. Well, maybe the tested half was the half that had nothing in it. We don't know. Yeah. I will say that when they're breaking it down for IV use, that test strip should be very, very reliable, right? If it's the chemical substance is now broken down and they're using it in some way intravenous. So again, not talking about the one pill can kill kiddo, talking about somebody struggling with intravenous addiction. Could be helpful in that situation. But when we're talking about a group of kids just looking to have a good time and train something new, I would be really hesitant just to rely on a tested substance, because you do not know if the rest of the chocolate chips are on the other side of the cookie. We just don't know.
What are some good ways of prevention, do you think? Like, what do you think about harm reduction?
I think the advocacy and education components of harm reduction are key. I think getting people yeah. out there in communities like our San Francisco streets, right? Can't have mm-hmm. enough Narcan on the street. You yeah. cannot. So those folks who are out there, and I don't know if you've seen the documentaries or done any reading about this, but there are teams that are actually moving around these infiltrated cities with Narcan, and they're ready to respond. Yeah. Helpful? Yeah. Yes. But what do you do with that guy after? Because Marcus, he overdosed twice. And then the second overdose was so bad that he had a neurological tick that took about 10 days to go away. It was in the course of those 10 days that he's like, no, I've got to get help. This almost killed me, right? Because he was revived already twice. And now he has a tick and his eyes aren't working correctly. He's like, no, something's wrong here. So what do you do with that person who has been revived and been revived? And how do we keep them from being another statistic like my son? That's the question. So yeah, we can intervene. We can slow the overdoses or the fatal overdoses, right? But if we don't have a service in the middle, a way to help them somewhere between Narcan and the next hit,
right?
Then I don't know how effective it really is. So it's out there. There are tools, there are resources. Just pray for our youth.
I know. It's a complex issue, and I am for a lot of harm reduction, and I'm a very conservative Christian individual, and you know, and my husband's not. And so we have this talk a lot, you know, because I've lost someone just like you have. And once you lose a loved one, to me, it's like, okay, so give them, what's wrong with handing out clean needles? So now they're not going to get AIDS. And so, but then other people are like, well, no, that's enabling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think with harm reduction, so that's what harm reduction is having clean injection sites or clean needles or, you know, or Narcan or all these things so that people don't die. And I think you and I would both agree that that's the most important piece. But like you were saying, so to me, it'd be great if, like you said, it was, and a lot of times it is involved with like, okay, here's a clean needle. And I just want you to know that I love you and I'm here for you. And when you're ready to quit, and here's some resources and here's some treatment centers. And so now we're letting them know they care. And that could be the catalyst. That could be the most important conversation or the most loving thing that someone had ever said to them. So when it's right, when it's combined with other things rather than just like handing out free stuff, I think that can be very powerful, you know?
So yeah, in general, anytime we're trying to like put a Band-Aid over a problem, which would be just the clean needle, right? Here's your clean needle. Mm-hmm. That's a Band-Aid.
Right.
It's got to be attached to a more meaningful service or more meaningful, like that heartfelt conversation, like you were saying. Maybe it is. I just need to know somebody cares, somebody hears me. I know for sure, though, with fentanyl, just the potency, right? 100 times more powerful than morphine. That is significant. And once your brain is expecting that kind of a hit, that kind of a high, it's really, really hard. And they just do need people to come along beside them and to give them the help and the support beyond just hey, here's the Narcan. Glad you didn't die this time. And I know I speak really matter of fact about that, but every five minutes, somebody's dying. We've been here chatting for 40 minutes, how many people have died, right? When we take it into the chunks of our life, when we take
like nine people. Oh my gosh.
Right. It's a lot to process.
Tracy, you and Marcus was in several treatment centers, right?
Yeah.
What did you notice about that? What did you think was good, bad, or lacking, or otherwise?
Man, another loaded question. You're good at these. So it's different from stage of his life to stage of his life and program to program. I know for sure he was in a faith-based rehabilitation program for about 8 months. And that was
Wow. Okay.
The most impactful, and I'm the most, just the most grateful for that time, because I know he was baptized in that time. I've been so blessed in reading some of his journal entries that just tell me that his soul is at rest with the Lord. And so while fighting this big, ugly monster of addiction, he was still drawn in and embraced forgiveness and rededicated his life to the Lord over and over and over again. And and I see this through the life of his journals, which is really cool to, if you're when you have that opportunity, just to dig a little deeper into who a person is, so to read his writings and to know. And a lot of that happened in recovery, whether it was the medical recovery as a young teen or the faith-based as a mature adult. A lot of the different focuses is this processing through the journal, right? And so that really is a gift to look in and see who he was at the core, right? So that was a treasure. I think institutionally, he had some struggles. He came back from North Star Behavioral Health, and he had some stories of people who cared so much and really went out on a limb to make him feel valued and loved. And he came back and he had some stories of times when his soul was just crushed. And so, I would say it comes down to the practitioner. Within every organization, you're going to have people who are there for the right reason. And you're going to have people who've been there just too long and they're ready to hang up their hat. And then there's just not always goodness of it. So I might not be the best candidate for you, or maybe I am. So Marcus really had a mixed bag of responses to treatment and therapy.
It's tough too. And you know, you have to have the person do a really good assessment, and are they addressing the underlying issues, right? You know, is this person have a personality disorder or what? But I know then when they need to fill the beds, they need to fill the beds. So sometimes you have people that aren't the right fit. And when that happens, it's not going to work. But I know in working with the opioid, I would say, in my opinion, probably 90% of those people needed inpatient treatment.
Right.
Like, you're not going to, you know, you're doing meth in the morning, heroin at night, you're taking fentanyl, a dose of, of, you know, you're living in a park and a dose of methadone's not, you need
a little Suboxone.
And you're schizophrenic or, you know what I mean? So it's just, it's hard because, and the practitioners, they're really young because they're out of college and they're not getting paid. And like, I have an MS in addiction counseling and it's like $20 an hour, $22, you know, and then the therapists are getting like $80 an hour. I mean, it, you know, that's on the extreme end, but it's like, okay, come on. You know, you say we have a crisis, you say we, you know, not you, but you know, we say, oh, we have this drug epidemic. What are we going to do? Well, it's like, make it a little easier for practitioners and then, you know, pay them a little better, right? I mean, you know, there's just so many problems, but
there are, yes. Listen, I just know that it takes a lot of heart. You've got to be this caregiving person that really is there to respond to those needs, and some people just have it naturally. Marcus was trippy, and I know you spoke about with your brother the crazy, right? When he passed away, and the crazy just kind of like, okay, that can be over now. And I don't know about your experience as a family member, but for us, when Marcus, God bless him, when he would go to therapy or to treatment, or when he would have his sabbaticals away, we all just took a deep breath, because for our own sake, our own mental processing, we needed that moment just to take a break from everything that addiction entailed and brought into our lives. So it was just like this big, deep breath. And so when he would come back and we would have these little honeymoons, I would be elated, right? Because we missed him. We love him, but we were glad he was two things, gone and safe. Because we needed a break. And it's terrifying, the not knowing when they're out on the streets and they're not either in jail, which Marcus had like two nights in jail in his whole life. He did really well of staying out of the legal system. So that was good. But the heartache of not knowing where you are, am I going to get that knock on the door? Am I going to get that phone call? Right? That not knowing.
Terrifying.
It's too much. Yeah.
Was he ever diagnosed with a mental health disorder or personality disorder?
Yeah. So as a young boy, 12, he was ODD, so oppositional defiance disorder, at 12. And so he was never, that didn't ever officially or on paper transition into conduct disorder, but I would say that he fit the bill for the diagnosis. He did have a marijuana-induced cognitive delay was another official mm-hmm. diagnosis for Marcus. So he had, at a super young age, again, smoked enough marijuana that it impaired his cognitive processing. And I felt like, wow, yeah. how does my child already? And so I think, to his advantage, he moved around, to his medical records advantage, maybe not. He moved around so much that records didn't always keep up with themselves or with yeah. him. So yeah. he didn't have a solid diagnosis or rank super as far as medical goes.
Yeah. And that's important for parents mm-hmm. and kids to know, because when I was mm-hmm. drinking, I was treating an anxiety disorder. We're mm-hmm. you know, people do mm-hmm. stuff for a reason. And most kids, they're just trying to fix what's broken. And so sometimes if we can get a correct medication, you know, mm-hmm. to try to fix the neurons and stuff like that, we can really help with addiction. And a lot of people don't realize that. It's like, oh, they're just an addict. Well, no, they're probably trying to fix what's broken. You know, they're yeah. trying to fix what's wrong. They're just going about it in a really wrong way.
Right.
Because when you're 14, all you know is the alcohol makes you the life of the party. Now you're not stressed. Now you fit mm-hmm. in, right? And so
super cool.
Right. Yeah. So, well, Tracy, tell us how we can get involved to bring awareness to fentanyl first, and then secondly, let people know about your book and the work that you're doing.
Will do. Okay. So in my local area, I've joined the fentanyl task force and looking through.
Nice.
Yeah. So most communities now, it's like I said, rising on the scene. So depending on where you're located, you can reach out to, most of the time, funding's coming through the health department. So if you're struggling a little bit with tying the ends together, the money starts with the local health departments, and then a task force is usually put together after that, right? And so that's when you see a lot of local billboards, outreach programs, communication in schools, things like that. So any advocacy and education, local components is what you'd want to tie your help to if you really wanted to get involved on a local level. I know through social media, tons and tons of opportunities to participate in different like Facebook groups or hashtags for awareness, things like that. So especially with our young kiddos who are super inundated with media, it is an effective tool because they're seeing it, they're sharing it, they're talking about things. There are tons of creators who are doing like reels for people and just sharing the story the best that they can. So depending on personality or personal interests, it would just be how much of my life do I have to give to the fentanyl crisis? Is it 15 minutes? Is it a quick Facebook post? Or do I want to get out and distribute Narcan? Do I want to talk to people on the street? So I think that's a personal choice, but there are plenty of opportunities. I know here in our local area, we have a church that comes on Wednesday nights at 6 o'clock at the local Walmart, right? The little hub of all people. So passing out Narcan, feeding folks, and then just praying for them. And so that's a really cool thing to be involved with. Here in the Yuba Center area, just outside of Sacramento, we are working on our Black Balloon Day initiative. So what that is going to be is a month long, so the full month of March, we're going to do a media balloon release. And what that's going to look like is 30 to 40 stores across Yuba Center are going to have black balloons where people can stop and just take a picture and do their little tribute in front of the black balloons. They can write on it, like for me, Marcus, forever 27. Marcus was 27. Then share it pretty widely just to get those black balloons flying out there digitally. But then thankfully, on March 6th, Black Balloon Day. So for those of you that don't know, Black Balloon Day is March 6th. It's in honor of overdose, and it's Overdose Awareness Day, right? So our community is going to come together and do an actual balloon release in Yuba City. So we're looking forward to that.
Nice.
Yeah. So just looking for opportunities to get out there and say, hey, this is an issue. Let me talk to you. Let me tell you about how some of the things that are happening took my son, and how I can maybe help you help somebody that you know. So that's my heart, and that's my mission. Just really looking to impact lives, and basically just talking to people, being that outlet, being a next level of support whenever it's needed.
And you wrote a book. It's not out yet, is my understanding. It's coming out. And tell people about your book, website. I know you've written some articles and things like that.
Sure. Happy to. Thank you. So you guys just got a really nice preview to my book, because my book is just that Marcus's story, starting as a young boy, some of the things he went through, and talking about those red flags, the things that I didn't know were red flags until it was too late. My hope is that sharing Marcus's story, sharing my experience, is really going to impact others, that it's going to shine a light on the fentanyl crisis, on what we can do. Even in my situation now, raising a five-year-old, man, the way I'm talking to this child, the way I'm doing things, it's not the same. And that's important to talk about. So my book is just going through all of these pieces of our life, our journey, and it's just really as a prayer, right, that society is impacted by the loss of my son. You can follow me.
And when's it come out?
March 10th is Marcus's would be his 30th birthday. So in tribute to him, we're holding it to release on his birthday, March.
Okay.
So,
what's it called?
Shadows of Grief, losing a child to the fentanyl epidemic.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. Any parting words for Marcus? Mm-hmm. Anything you just want to kind of say about him?
Marcus, you know, then I'll get all emotional.
Just like one, two sentences.
You know, it was just God's greatest gift to me to be his mom. It was short, but it was good.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, Tracy, do you have you sent me your website. You have a website, right? What is it?
Yeah, shadowsofgrief.com.
Okay, and then, cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, we will be looking for the book.
Thank you.
Praying for you, and thank you so much for sharing all this information and being willing to come on and share Marcus's story as well.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jody.
Thank you so much, friends, for listening to Genuine Life Recovery, playing on your favorite app or on my website at jodystevens.org. It's JodieStevens, jodystevens.org. There you can check out my podcast, blog, recovery coaching info, speaking, and more. Check it out.